Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.
Episode of Cowboy Chemistry. I am your host, Dylan Gardner. My pronouns are they, them. And my guest today is Gabby Settlemyer. She's my friend, an undergrad student, and a ceramicist.
That I am.
So Gabby, how much do you know about chemistry?
Honestly, I should know a lot more. I've taken chemistry... In high school, I took it twice. Not because I failed, but because we had an advanced chemistry class, and you had to take another STEM class in order to graduate. And the chemistry teacher let us light stuff on fire. So I was like, yes, I will take Mr. Hanfeld again. And then I've taken it twice in college, Chemistry 1 and Chemistry 2. I remember none of it, though.
All right. And then, have you ever heard of Rosalind Franklin?
Yes. So, I'm a biology major. Rosalind is the actual person that discovered DNA. Those two dudes that wrote that book and that paper totally ripped her off. That's all I know. She's like the one that came up with it, right?
Yes and no. I would say it's a little more complicated than them just stole it from her.
Oh, okay.
Because, like, really what they stole was kind of the data that led to the structure.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like she had it all figured out, and then they were like, ah.
Thank you, young lady.
Yeah. It wasn't quite like that, but I do think that they robbed her of a lot of credit. And so we're going to talk about her and how DNA was, the structure of DNA was discovered. So.
Bet.
I guess we'll just jump into it. Rosalind Franklin was born on July 25th in 1920 in Notting Hill, London. To his dad, her dad was Ellis Arthur Franklin, and he was a politically liberal London merchant banker. And he also taught at the Working Men's College. And her mother was Muriel Frances Whaley. She was the second of five children. And her family was really politically active and pretty influential. On her father's side, she had a great uncle, Viscount Herbert Samuel, who was the first practicing Jewish man to serve in the British cabinet as Home Secretary in 1916.
Progressive.
Yeah. She had an aunt, Helen Carolyn Franklin, who was active in trade union organizations and the suffragist movement in England. Her family was actively involved in the Working Men's College as well, which, by the way, is the oldest still standing adult education centers in all of Europe.
All right. Yeah. They real progressive. They ain't just a little progressive. I see you.
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. I mean, they are also still very traditional family. Like, yeah. And her father taught electricity, magnetism, and the history of the Great War, which the Great War is World War I, and that's what they called it before World War II. So during World War II, or really right before World War II, her parents actually helped with kinder transport and resettling a lot of the Jewish children that were rescued out of Nazi Germany. And I believe they had two of the kids in their own home, and they took in kids as well. So, and then she had an uncle who was a bit of a black sheep of the family, who was involved in the suffrage movement as well. He went to prison many times for the suffrage movement. So at one point, after an encounter with the police, with police brutality at a protest for women's suffrage, you know, basically there was this protest, and then the police basically came and, like, beat up a bunch of women. And a lot of people were really mad at Winston Churchill for this, because he was the Home Secretary, and so they blamed him for this police brutality. And keep in mind, this was before Winston Churchill was, like, completely Winston Churchill, as far as, like, the mythical man we think of that he became during World War II. But yeah, so he started, like, kind of stalking Winston Churchill, and whenever he saw him, he would heckle him. And then at one point, they were on a train together, and so he attacked Winston Churchill with a dog whip. And he said, "Take this, you cur, for the treatment of the suffragists." Just beat him with a dog whip.
He knows what's up.
And he only got 6 weeks in jail for that.
Oh no, you'd probably be fully sentenced today.
Yeah. yeah, so, and then later, after he got out of jail, he got arrested again because he was throwing rocks at Winston Churchill's house.
So, he was real pissed.
And he went to jail for, like, a month for that. And then, I'm not fully sure what the motivation for this last part was, but 2 years later, he set a train car on fire and was sentenced to another 6 months in jail for that. I'm not sure how setting the train car on fire was for suffrage. That's the part I don't understand. but he was released early because he had been force-fed 114 times while in prison. Yeah. But yeah, now all of that was very embarrassing to the Franklin family. Like, they did not like that he did all of that. But what I think is just kind of funny is he finally got disowned, not for any of that, but because he married not one, but two non-Jewish women, both named Elise.
Well, you didn't want to get them mixed up, so you gotta get the ones with the same name, right?
Yeah, so that's what got him disowned, was
marrying two non-Jewish women.
Yeah.
With the same name.
Yeah. To be clear, the one died before he married the second one.
Okay. That's like better. That's a lot better, because I was thinking, homeboy has two wives, and he's going home to both of them separately, but he doesn't want to confuse either of them, so he's like, ah, yes, my love, Elise.
Yeah. But anyway, back to Franklin. That was just an aside, because I thought that was a funny story. So, for Rosalind, she started her education at 6 at Norland Place School. Her aunt described her at the time as alarmingly clever. She spends all her time doing arithmetic for pleasure and invariably gets her sums right.
Yeah, not me.
She had an early interest in cricket and hockey. And then at 9, she went to a boarding school called Lindor School for Young Ladies in Sussex. And finally, at 11, she went to St. Paul's Girls' School in Hammersmith, West London. And this is notable because this was one of the only girls' schools at the time that taught physics and chemistry.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was, like, a rumor later that her dad didn't want her to go to college, like, and be educated and have a career. And her family has thoroughly debunked that and been like, no, why would he send her to this top-notch school?
That has chemistry and physics.
Yeah, if he didn't want her to be educated, at least, you know? I mean, he's definitely been a traditional man, like, from what I read about him, but, like, he never disapproved of her going to college. That was not a thing. We'll talk about it later, as far as he kind of wanted her to drop out at one point, but that's for a whole other reason. But she learned German and French there, and her only educational weakness was in music. The school's music director, a composer called Gustav Holst, once called upon her mother to inquire whether she had hearing problems or tonsillitis.
If that were me, they would probably be asking the same thing.
I could play instruments, but I can't sing. So they were expecting me to sing, absolutely.
Absolutely.
But yeah, she graduated in 1938 with 6 distinctions. And Franklin was accepted into the Newnham College, which is part of Cambridge University.
Ooh, schmancy.
Yeah. There she studied chemistry within the natural sciences tripos. I think I'm saying that right. Essentially, instead of having like what we would consider a major today, you studied like a broader area of the natural sciences. So you would take chemistry, physics, mathematics, astronomy, geoscience, and then you would get like history and philosophy of science along with it. So it's kind of more of a holistic almost. Like, you didn't study all of it. It sounds like you picked like 3 of those things and like focused in 3. So she got her bachelor's there, and then she started her PhD study at the same institution. Her advisor was originally Ronald George Norrish, who he actually wins the Nobel Prize later in 1967. But at the time, he was apparently a heavy drinker, and his own biographer describes him as obstinate and almost perverse in argument, overbearing and sensitive to criticism. And he apparently would not assign anything to her. So after like a year of trying to work under him and start working on her PhD, she hadn't done anything. She couldn't accomplish anything because he wouldn't assign her to do anything. Yeah, and Franklin wrote at the time that she despised him, hated him.
I mean, you would too if you were going to college and some homie was like, nah, I don't like you. So, sorry.
Right?
Figure like, it out.
I'm too busy drinking to be your PhD advisor, sorry. But she ends up resigning from his lab and goes to work for the British Coal Utilization Research Association in 1942 as part of the National Services Act in Britain. So that was kind of like a draft, but it wasn't just for the military. So it was required government or military service by all men 18 to 51 and women between 20 and 30, of course, with exceptions. So like if you had children, you didn't have to do that. But yeah, and this was partially encouraged by her father. Like I said, he kind of told her to drop out at one point, and this is part of why, because he felt like she should join the war effort that was going on. And her research there was on the porosity of coal. So that's basically how gases would permeate into coal, and like the size of the pores in coal. And basically, this research was used to, you know, not only was coal used for fuel, but possibly in gas masks as, like, a filter. And this work actually was able to be translated into her PhD thesis, The Physical Chemistry of Solid Organic Colloids with Special Reference to Coal. And so when World War II ended in 1945, she was awarded a PhD, and she asked her friends if she knew of anywhere with a job opening for a physical chemist who knows very little physical chemistry, but quite a lot about the holes in coal. And I've never heard anything more relatable. So at this point, she actually ends up going and working in France at the French National Center for Scientific Research. And this is where she got her experience with X-ray crystallography.
That's how she did it. That's how she got the X.
Got the X.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. They made us watch a video in like high school about her, and the picture that they showed us was an X, and it was just a singular section of like the DNA spiral.
Yeah, so what you're probably talking about is photo 51, I think is what they call it.
That's probably it.
And yeah, so Somebody called it at one point like the most beautiful x-ray pattern gotten from any chemical ever or something, which, I don't know, like, don't get me wrong, it's impressive, but I was also just like, that seems very romanticizing for a picture. That picture.
It's so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. but yeah, so, but you're right. That is where she gets her x-ray crystallography experience. She was working with rayon and other amorphous substances, so things that aren't crystalline.
Mm-hmm.
And so she combined her experience in coal and other carbonaceous material to determine why some carbon-based materials become graphite while others don't when you heat them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to focus on this a lot, but she coined the terms graphitizing and non-graphitizing carbon.
That's how we get pencils! Well, kind of.
And so this is the part where I ask you, do you know what x-ray crystallography is?
probably not. I'm imagining, like, fifth grade science, where you take the sponge and you put the sodium and stuff on it and it starts growing crystals. And that is definitely not what x-ray crystallography is.
So what you're talking about is just growing a crystal.
Yeah.
So you have to get a crystal first, you're absolutely right. But what x-ray crystallography is you have that crystal and you put it on this machine. And then you shoot x-ray beams at it, and then where the atoms are, the x-rays will get deflected off. Basically, it's like if you had an invisible structure, an invisible, like, statue, imagine, and then you wanted to figure out what the shape of your statue was. What you can do, like, one way you could figure it out is to throw balls at it and see where it bounces off, and then you get an idea of the shape. So it's the same kind of idea, except we're working really, really small. So our invisible thing, our invisible statue is these tiny molecules, and the balls we would be throwing at it are the x-rays.
All right, bet.
Yeah. So she worked in France until 1950, and then that's where she was offered a position to work at King's College London in the Medical Research Council's biophysical unit, directed by John Randall. When they originally hired her, they told her she was going to work on proteins and lipids, using x-ray crystallography to figure out the structures of proteins and lipids. However, John Randall reassigns her to work on DNA, because there was a big recent breakthrough on DNA. And that breakthrough was done by Rudolf Signer. He, in 1950... he prepared a highly purified sample of DNA. He got it from a calf thymus. And he was just freely giving away this sample to anyone he thought would need it.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave one of these samples to Maurice Wilkins, who was working at King's College as well. And Wilkins and a graduate student called Raymond Gosling were working with this sample. They were not experienced crystallographers, but they did manage to get really good data off this sample, so it was really promising. With Franklin having a lot more x-ray crystallography experience, Randall told her that she would be working with the grad student Ryan Gosling, and it would just be those two. And so basically Randall had kicked Wilkins off this project, but he never told Wilkins.
Oh. Phenomenal.
So, yeah, so, and Wilkins was, like, on vacation when Franklin got there. So Franklin got there, thought she would be working by herself with this grad student, and then Wilkin comes back, he thinks he's in charge, and he thinks that Franklin is basically an assistant, doesn't realize that Randall put her in charge, and Randall just never told Wilkins.
He's like, we're just gonna not deal with the conflict here.
Yeah. Yeah, it only gets worse.
Oh.
So when she got there, a couple of new nice things. So a fine focus x-ray tube and a microcamera, which had been ordered by Wilkins, had come in. So she set that up and focused everything. She made a camera chamber with humidity control, so she used different saturated salt solutions to control how much humidity was in there with the sample. At some point, Wilkins came in and asked her about this new setup. She explained it to him, and he apparently got mad because she had an air of cool superiority. Part of me was just like, she's just confident. She just knows what she's talking about.
Yeah.
That's how it seems to me, because people described her as having, being concise and direct and, like, making eye contact the entire time. And she just strikes me as someone who's very confident, knows what they're talking about, and is, you know, not very, I don't know. She doesn't beat around the bush, you know? Yeah. She's like, this is what it is. I set this up. This is what I did. And yeah, and if she knows what she's talking about and Wilkins didn't, I don't know. How is that cold superiority when it's just confidence?
He just made it.
It just seemed like, I just didn't quite understand why that, I mean, I wasn't there, but.
Are you sure you weren't there?
But I can't imagine, like, someone explaining something to me and, like, feeling like they were coldly
seen. You're being condescending.
Right? From what I understood of how Wilkins treated her, I mean, like, maybe she was kind of condescending, because, like, if she's being treated like an assistant when she's supposed to be in charge, I mean, like, you're gonna get irritated.
Like, you will get really irritated, especially if you're, like, one of few, very, very few women in STEM at the time.
Yeah, based on one of the biographies I read, it was Rosalind Franklin and one other woman at King's College at the time. Just those two.
Yep.
Also, there were two separate dining rooms for men and women.
So the women's dining room was like a closet, since there are only two of them?
Well, so, I mean, there were, I guess, women, there were more women there,
yeah,
like, as staff and other things, but as far as researchers, it was just her and Rosalind. So, I don't know how they compared size-wise, but I just know that they were separated, which is weird.
Yeah.
Apparently, the explanation is that King's College was a seminary, and so they separated the men and women for religious reasons. Mm-hmm. And then King's College, being a seminary, was very male-dominated because the Church of England doesn't ordain women. So, like, there would be no women in their seminary, and that was the majority of the college.
Yeah.
So, that was the explanation given in the book. But I think it does lead to quite a bad atmosphere when people are segregated. I think history has proved that if you separate people for no reason, people get treated differently. They get treated as other.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, we'll go on to this, what she first discovered about DNA, especially with this humidity control. So she found that at 75% humidity, it had an extended thin structure that was called aDNA. And when you decrease the humidity, it would become shorter and thicker, and that was called bDNA. And so she also seemed to know very quickly that the bDNA sample had a helical structure and not a straight chain. So, and that there was phosphate groups on the backbone of the DNA. So she figured all of that out, what seems like fairly quickly. What she wasn't sure of was how many chains there were. So she wasn't sure, and she also wasn't sure if the thinner version of aDNA was also helical. So if it still had that same structure as bDNA. And she was, like, really meticulous, and she would not make conclusions without data. So she, and this is, like, a philosophical thing in science. You're supposed to go where the DNA, where the data leads you, right? You're not supposed to say, oh, this is how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what it is, and I'm going to get this data to prove this theory I have. You're supposed to get the data and then make your conclusions. And so she was very much, like, she did not want to speculate. She said at one point, we are not going to speculate. We are going to wait, and we are going to let the spots on this photograph tell us what the DNA structure is. And, I mean, that's really how science is supposed to work, right? You're supposed to follow the data. And like I said, it only gets worse. So eventually the feud between Wilkins and Franklin lead them to having to work completely separately. So Franklin got the A DNA and Wilkins got B DNA. But that didn't stop them from messing with each other. And Franklin and the grad student Gosling at one point wrote a funeral announcement for A-DNA as like a prank on Wilkins, because Wilkins would apparently like always say that A-DNA was dead or not relevant, or I'm not fully sure what he was saying, but like he would like mess with them, and so this was their way of messing with him back, I guess. And this funeral announcement says, "It is with great regret that we have to announce the death on Friday, 18th July, 1952, of DNA helix crystalline. Death followed a protracted illness, which was an intensive course of bezalid injections, had failed to relieve. A memorial service will be held next Monday or Tuesday. It is hoped that Dr. M.H.F. Wilkins will speak in memory of the late Helix." Sign, Rosalind Franklin and Raymond Gosling.
Lovely. At least she had a sense of humor.
She definitely did. And that's one thing that's really interesting, how people will describe her after she passes away. A lot of her, like, American colleagues that she knew would describe her as, like, really funny and, like, easy to get along with. And all of her British colleagues were like, she was so hard to get along with.
Probably because, like, I don't know, like, when you think about it, proper English or proper British people, they're just a lot more, there's a lot more air of seriousness to them than when I think of, like, an American.
I mean, maybe that's what it was. I'm not sure, like, I'll read a bit from Watson's book later, The Double Helix, and so I don't necessarily think it was, like, the seriousness of it, like, that they were taking it way more seriously. Like, some of them, maybe, that's, they wanted to be more serious, but at least Watson, it was not that. But yeah, by January 1953, Franklin had reconciled her conflicting data, concluding that both DNA forms had two helixes, or helices, and had started to write a series of three draft manuscripts, two of which included a double helical DNA backbone. Her two A-DNA manuscripts reached Attica Crystallographa, which is the big X-ray crystallographer, like, journal. It still is. It's probably one of the bigger ones for X-ray crystal structures. And but it reached their desk, the manuscripts reached their desks on March 6th, 1953, one day before Crick and Watson had completed their model on B-DNA. So it's pretty clear that she knew that DNA was helical by that point. Like, mm-hmm. like she had known. But in February 1953, James Watson and Francis Crick of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge University had started to build their molecular model of B-DNA using data similar to that available to both teams at King's. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was a lecture given by Franklin in 1952 that DNA was helical with either two or three strands. And at first, based on that, they had constructed a triple helix model. So it would have three strands instead of two, which was immediately proven to be flawed. They were like, this can't be it. Franklin's research was completed by February 1953, ahead of her move to Birkbeck. So she ends up leaving King's College because of this personality clash. Like, she just couldn't get along with her co-workers there. The model building had been applied successfully in the elucidation of the alpha helix by Linus Pauling in 1951. But again, Franklin was super opposed to prematurely building theoretical models until sufficient data was there to guide that model building. Like, she just didn't think there was enough data yet to make this model. She felt her conviction was justified when people put up that erroneous, the triple helix thing. They were like, she was like, come on, you don't have enough data to make this
conclusion.
And so when she transferred to her new job, Brickbed College, Randall insisted that all the DNA work must stay at King's College.
Mm-hmm.
So Wilkins was given copies of all of Franklin's diffraction photographs, and the work of Gosling. So Gosling's the graduate student. And by February 28th of 1953, Watson and Crick felt that they had solved the problem enough for Crick to proclaim in a local pub that they had found the secret of life. However, they knew they had to complete their model before they could be certain. And Watson and Crick finished building their model on the 7th of March, 1953, one day before receiving a letter from Wilkins stating that Franklin was finally leaving and that they could put all hands to the pump.
All right.
Upon completion of their model, Crick and Watson had invited Wilkins to be a co-author on their paper describing the structure.
Even though she had provided an adequate amount of research for them to...
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it sounds like Wilkins was the one kind of giving them this data and showing it to them. And yeah, and he later regretted that he didn't take the co-authorship because basically, like, he didn't realize that Watson and Crick had used their x-ray data in creating the model. Like, he thought that they kind of figured it out on their own without this x-ray crystal data being significant in it, you know. But there is absolutely no doubt that Franklin's experimental data was used by Crick and Watson to build their model. And some, including this woman Maddox, who was one of Franklin's biographers, have explained that this citation by omission, by suggesting that it may have been a question of circumstance because it was difficult to cite unpublished work. Mm-hmm. So basically, Franklin hadn't published this yet, and so they couldn't cite her. Because in their citations, they said, like, inspired by the work of Franklin and Gosling at some point, or Franklin and Wilkins, I think. And, like, there's a difference between being inspired by something and using their data.
Yeah.
And I think ethically at this point, they should have made her a co-author.
Yeah.
She should have been a co-author from the beginning.
Yeah. But the question is, did they know that Wilkins was the one primarily providing the data? Like, did they know if that was mostly his data or if he was gathering that data from somewhere else?
I am not sure how much they knew about where this data was coming from. It seems like they did know it was Rosalind.
Yeah.
Because in Watson's book, Double Helix, he talks about Rosalind Franklin a lot.
Yeah.
And to me, that suggests that he knows that this data is coming from her and Gosling.
Yeah.
At the time, I guess it would have been really awkward for them to talk about the manner at which the data had gotten from King's to Cambridge.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing about why they didn't
divulge.
Give her credit is because that was not really above board for them to be sharing this information. And in one of her biographies by Maddox, such acknowledgments as they gave her were very muted, always coupled with the name of Wilkins. So if they ever mentioned her at all, it was always with Wilkins. They would never say that Franklin... And that's why I say I think they knew from the beginning that Franklin...
Had a big part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They knew. They knew she had a big part of it. They just didn't like her and didn't want to include her.
Phenomenal. We love people like that.
So a few weeks later, on April 10th, Franklin wrote to Crick for permission to see their model. Franklin, of course, maintains her skepticism because she doesn't like premature model building. When she saw it, apparently she said something along the lines of, "It's very pretty, but how are you going to prove it?"
This looks great, but, like, how do you know this is what this actually looks like?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, she always wants to make sure that there's good evidence for before you publish a proposed model. So Crick and Watson published their model in Nature on April 25th, 1953, in an article describing the double helical structure of DNA, with only a footnote acknowledging having been stimulated by the general knowledge of Franklin and Wilkins' unpublished contribution. Basically, they had just enough specific knowledge of Franklin and Gosling's data to base their model. So, and then they just didn't give him any credit. And then later, Wilkins and Franklin would publish their X-ray diffraction data in second and third papers in Nature, seemingly only in support of Crick and Watson. So, like, not that their data came first. Their data is backing up the model.
Ah.
Instead of
the actual way in which it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it made it very much seem like with Watson and Crick came first, Rosalind and Wilkins followed up with their information. So Franklin ends up leaving King's College in mid-March 1953 for Birkbeck College. In a move that had been planned for some time, that she had described in a letter to her friend as moving from a palace to the slums, but pleasanter all the same. So basically, obviously, King's College had great facilities, and Birkbeck College did not. She was still happy to be there. And I think it's pretty clear why at this point. She was recruited by a physics department chair, John Desmond Bernal. He was a crystallographer who was also a communist, and he was known for promoting women crystallographers. Despite his parting words to have her stop her interest in nucleic acids, she still helped Gosling finish his thesis, although she was no longer officially his supervisor. So she still helps her grad student.
She's got a heart, man.
Yeah, I think she's a perfectly fine person.
They just hate her because she knows too much.
That's kind of what it seems like. I really don't understand why there was such a conflict there. Like, because again, other people, Americans, other people, like, thought that she was great. It seems like it's just the people at King's College at the time who didn't like her. And I guess at Cambridge, because of Watson and Crick, like, those folks were being weird, and I don't understand. But yeah, Gosling and Franklin published their double helix evidence for DNAA in July 25th of Nature of 1953. And by the end of 1954, Bernal had secured funding for Franklin from the Agricultural Research Council, which enabled her to work as a senior scientist supervising her own research group. So she was fully in charge now. There was no question. And so she moved away from DNA and went to RNA, equally important to life. She still used X-ray crystallography to study the structure of the tobacco mosaic virus, which is an RNA virus. And they soon discovered and published in 1956 that the covering of the TMV virus was proteins arranged in a helix, which I just thought was interesting. There was, again, a helix. The Birkbeck team continued working on RNA viruses and of several plants, including potatoes, turnips, tomatoes, peas. Like, they were cranking it out. They were doing great. But unfortunately, in mid-1956, Franklin began to suspect she was having health problems. She found it difficult zipping up her skirt, and her stomach had bulged. A friend would ask her, "You're not pregnant," to which she retorted, "I wish I were." But after going to the doctor and everything, she had an operation on the 4th of September that same year, revealing two tumors in her abdomen. Even while undergoing cancer treatment, Franklin continued to work, and her group published 7 papers in 1956 and 6 more in 1957.
That's a lot of papers.
Yeah. Like
a lot of papers.
Yeah. No, she was doing fantastic. And at the end of 1957, she fell ill again and was admitted to the hospital. On December 2nd, she made her will, and she returned to work in January of 1958. And she was given a promotion to research associate in biophysics on the 25th of February. but then she finally fell ill again on the 30th of March, and she died on April 16th, 1958, of ovarian cancer.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Of course, what caused this cancer, she was working with x-rays, so I'm sure that didn't help. And that's definitely a factor in her cancer, but from what I was researching, her family had a lot of history of cancer, and gynecological cancers is disproportionately higher among Ashkenazi Jewish populations already. X-rays absolutely can cause cancer, and it probably played a factor, but genetics were also not in her favor.
Yeah.
And when she passed away, apparently, like, on her deathbed, she was talking to a friend, and she said she just wanted to be part of the Royal Society of Chemistry by the time she was 40, and she died at 37.
Dude, she would have if she had lived.
Yeah, she probably would have. Yeah. Watson and Francis Crick and Maurice Wilkins received the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology in 1962 for this work. And if she would have lived, she should have been included.
A part of that too, yeah.
Yeah. And interestingly, so now there's rules. So if you have passed away, you cannot win a Nobel Prize. You have to be alive to win a Nobel Prize. But at the time that they won the Nobel Prize, that was a practice and not officially a rule. So they could have given her the Nobel credit. Prize and credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. They could have.
They were just like,
Yeah.
That's so messed up.
Yeah. And they rarely mention her in their Nobel Prize speeches. Like, I don't think they mention her at all.
Why?
Yeah.
I mean, we know why, because they're kind of not the nicest people, and they didn't like her. But, like, that's sad. Like, that was a large portion of her life's work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, probably the biggest portion, and she had no idea. Or, I think she knew, but she was never fighting for that credit.
Well, so, from what I understand, she did not know that Watson and Crick had seen her data.
Oh, okay.
So she didn't know.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
No, that's so messed up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, from what it sounds like, Wilkins was the one showing them this data.
Yeah, and being like, look, guys, this is great. Can you do something with this?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my god, I know what I'm doing. And then she was like, oh, well, I guess they figured it out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, yeah. They
I'm
thought
mad
that,
for her.
Huh?
I'm mad for her.
A lot of people were mad for her. After her death, the discussions of the life of Rosalind Franklin, specifically at her time at King's College London, was to talk about, like, the rampant sexism at the institution. Anne Sayre, one of Franklin's friends and one of her biographers, says in her 1975 book, Rosalind Franklin and DNA, that in 1951, King's College London was, as an institution, not as distinguished for the welcome that it offered to women. Rosalind was unused to purdah, which is a religious and social institution of female seclusion. So, like, when you separate the genders based on religious or institutional reasons. There was only one other woman scientist on the laboratory staff. And Sayre asserts that while the male staff at King's lunched in a large, comfortable, rather clubby dining room, the female staff of all ranks lunched in the student hall or away from the premises.
Oof.
Yeah. Some of the other discussions that come out is some people don't like Sayre's description of her as being particularly feminist because Rosalind Franklin was just a scientist trying to do science. Like, she was not trying to be revolutionary in any kind of way as far as she just wanted to do science. She thought of herself as a scientist. And I think a lot of scientists think of themselves that way. Like, they don't care about nothing else. They just want to do their science. But yeah, a lot of people wrote about her after her death, and some in really positive ways and some in really negative ways. So the first one that came out was The Double Helix by Watson. His writing of her is just so mean.
Atrocious.
So mean. He calls her Rosie throughout the book.
Oh, instead of what she actually went by. Like, it would have been different if they had a relationship like that, but I don't even know these people, and they sound like they hate each other.
Yeah, yeah, they fully did not like each other. But, yeah, and she did not go by Rosie. At no point, nobody who was her friend even called her Rosie.
It was just kind of as, like, a way to put someone down.
Yeah, 100%. It was, like, an embarrassing thing for him. And he, I'm going to read a little excerpt about where he talks about seeing Rosalind giving the November speech lecture about where he first figures out kind of about the helical structure, which in that lecture she talks about it being a helix of either two or three strands. By mid-November, when Rosie's talk on DNA rolled about, I had learned much about the crystallographic argument to follow much of her lecture. Most importantly, I knew what to focus attention upon. 6 weeks of listening to Francis Crick had made me realize that the crux of the matter was whether Rosie's new X-ray picture would lend any supporting details that which might prove clues in constructing molecular models. So immediately, you can tell he's thinking about, oh, I wonder what this crystallographic data is telling us about the structure. Like, he knows that this is significant.
Yeah. He's like, I know she is something groundbreaking, but that's so messed up.
And here he's describing how she speaks. She spoke to an audience of about 15 in a quick, nervous style that suited an unornamented old lecture hall in which we were seated. There was not a trace of warmth or frivolity in her words, and yet I could not regard her as totally uninteresting. Momentarily, I wondered how she would look if she took off her glasses and did something novel with her hair. Then, however, my main concern was her description of the crystalline X-ray diffraction pattern.
That's so messed up. He's like, man, she ugly. But, like, she could look better. Oh, wait, I'm here for this again. I'm sorry. Let me reframe. Oh, yeah, what can she teach me?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of creepy that in the book he puts her picture right here.
Yeah, that is creepy. That's weird. He's like, look, is she ugly? Is she pretty? Validate my thoughts, please.
Yeah, and it's just so, it's such a weird That's thing so to say. Weird. It's so weird and mean for no reason. The woman, by the time he publishes this, the woman had been dead for like 10, 15 years.
He just got tea and he wants to share it.
I guess. It's just unbelievably rude. And he doesn't talk about just Rosalind this way. He talks about Crick's wife in a similar manner at some dinner that they had went to. This is how he describes her. Ever since she had told him about the gravity went only 3 miles into the sky, this aspect of the relationship was set. Not only did she not know any science, but any attempt to put some in her head would be a losing fight against the years of her convent upbringing. The most hoped for was an appreciation of the linear way in which money was measured.
That's so messed up. He's like, she can't understand any of this. The most that we can hope that she can understand is that money either goes up or down.
Yeah.
That's so messed up.
And like the gravity only being 3 miles from the earth, like keep in mind this is the 1950s.
Yeah.
1950s, 1960s. And again, Rosalind went to the only school that taught girls physics and chemistry.
Yeah.
So this woman likely did not receive any formal education in science.
Yeah.
And so if you think about space, when you go up into space, you eventually reach the point where you're in orbit and it's zero gravity.
Yeah.
And so from a layman's perspective, of course, it seems like gravity ends when you reach space.
Yeah.
So that's not...
I mean, I've taken plenty of science classes, and I still think like that, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's... But it's not a she doesn't have any science in her brain, or she couldn't possibly understand this.
She's not educated! That's not her fault!
Exactly! Nobody took the time to explain this to her.
Yeah, they were just like, oh, she's not gonna get it, so let's just move past.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, she probably didn't need to know how gravity worked either. Like, why would she even care? But also, you shouldn't just be like, oh, well, she's just too stupid to get it.
Yeah.
Like, this just is so unbelievably mean.
Dude, Watson.
Yeah. He talks about, like, everyone in the book like that. Like, he says, like that about most scientists as being dumb and dull, basically.
Everyone compared to him.
I guess. Yeah, I just, reading it, I was like, wow, it's so mean.
This dude's rude.
For no reason. And keep in mind, like, especially, like, Crick and his wife were still alive when this came out.
Oh, no!
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. At least Crick was still alive when this book came out.
Crick, I'd be trying to fight that guy. Like, what'd you say about my wife?
Yeah, he apparently, like, told Watson, do not publish about me while I'm alive. That's a messed up thing to do.
He has no care.
Yeah. But yeah, and so it's just really, to me, been very interesting. And one of her siblings, Jennifer Glynn, which is her younger sister, she published her own book about it, where she says that all of these stories, both of Watson and Anne Sayer, so Anne Sayer is her biographer that kind of revealed all of this sexism that she was facing, but Anne Sayer kind of frames her as a feminist. And again, that's not completely accurate. Again, she was just like a scientist who wanted to do...
I'm sure that's just how Anne saw her. She was like, yes, queen, exactly. You were out here making things happen. You're in charge of me. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like she very much thought that... She thought of Rosalind as like a role model and as someone who was doing important stuff. And she was doing important stuff.
As one might say, she was seeing Rosalind through rosy glasses. Sorry, I couldn't.
But yeah, and her sister kind of calls out what she calls the Rosalind industry, where people are making her sister a feminist hero, or in Watson's book, I mean, he just...
A monster?
A monster, you know, and neither of that is true, right?
She's just a person.
She's just a person.
She's just a little science lady, man.
Yeah. So, but I just wanted to finish on what her sister had to say about her in her book. So, Rosalind became a symbol, first of an argumentative swot, then of a downtrodden woman scientist, and finally of a triumphant heroine in a man's world. She was none of these things, and she would have hated all of them. She was simply a very good scientist with an ambition, as she told Colin from her hospital bed, to be a fellow of the Royal Society before she was 40, but she died at 37. She would have liked the letter written to me in 2002 by Penny Cronin, a maid in their house at the outbreak of World War II, who had gone to her book group to hear about one of her biographies. Dear Mrs. Glynn, she wrote, although I could only have think of you as little Jennifer... I couldn't believe my ears when I realized that Rosalind Franklin was one of the family of five at Pembridge Place, by whom I was employed in 1937. So, yeah, I think it's just, you know, and then we do this to all historical figures, I think, more or less. We make these narratives about their lives when they were just people.
Yeah.
And I think it's both important to talk about what she faced, I mean, and first of all, to give her the credit she deserves, because again, she is a scientist, and if she did science, she deserves the credit for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, she faced sexism and anti-Semitism, possibly, and some people depict her as, you know,
she's not I don't know English right now. She's not Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She is a scientist.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't trying to do anything revolutionary. She was just trying to
do herself, man.
Yeah. I mean, it just comes down, and funny enough, a little credit to Watson, I don't think anybody would have ended up knowing about Rosalind Franklin had he not wrote this scathing book.
And been like, this lady's evil, she should have looked better.
Yeah, like, and if he had not been so mean to her in this book, prompting Anne Sayer's response and the subsequent responses, I think it would have been a difference. Like, it wouldn't have come to light.
Dirt. Huh? Dirt under the rug.
Yeah, it would have been completely covered up. But because Watson was, like, had to, like, drag her name through the mud for some reason, he made her more famous than ever before. Like, if he would have just not said anything about her, nothing would have happened, I think.
He's just real petty.
Yeah.
Just real petty.
But, I mean, I'm kind of glad he did it, because now we know that Rosalind Franklin deserves the credit. People say, like, the perfect world, basically Watson and Crick would have won their Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology, and Wilkins and Franklin would have won it in chemistry.
Yeah.
And that would have been the proper thing to happen.
Yeah.
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 And she should have been co-author on that first paper to begin with. And maybe Wilkins, too. I mean, he did him and Gosling. They all worked on it.
Now you think of it, it's usually... I mean, the grad students' names are on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, most work now is done by grad students.
Yeah, and then they have the professor, like, overseeing them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in chemistry anyway, the first author on the paper is the person who did the most work, or the most critical work. That's the first author. And then you list everyone else who contributed, and then the last person on the list is whatever laboratory supervisor it was done under.
Oh, okay.
So whoever the main professor in charge of the lab is the last author.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what order that would be as far as their work. I mean, that's usually written out and discussed by the authors. They all talk about it themselves and say, okay, you deserve first author, and you're going to be the corresponding author. Like, that all gets decided between them.
Watson and Crick, man.
Yeah.
Bunch of crooks.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. And... yeah, and it's still interesting because now we kind of know about Rosalind Franklin, but a lot of people still give all the credit to Watson and Crick. I mean, I went to a seminar the other day, and they still gave the credit to Watson and Crick and did not mention Franklin.
Yeah.
And, like, why? We know now. We should start giving her the credit.
They're probably just like, a lot of people don't know this, so I think we're just gonna...
Well, I think it's a lot of the older faculty.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Haven't, just didn't realize that it had been changed. Because a lot of, and too, you know, even with these biographies and stuff, the narrative didn't change. The publications are still the same. So if you're referencing the publications, it's just Watson and Crick.
Yeah.
So you have to go out of your way to acknowledge Franklin.
But it's not even, like, a big deal, though, man.
No,
like,
it's not. It's not.
Oh, no, I have to go out of my way to reference this lady rather than just saying, yeah, Rosalind Franklin, Watson and Crick, and my homie Wilkins.
It's that's the story, though. That's all I got. Thank you for being my first guest.
Yes!
I had fun.
I did.
I
learned some things.
You learned some things?
Yeah.
Can you tell me what X-ray crystallography is now?
X-ray crystallography is where you're taking pictures of something very, very small and you're X-raying it. Well, you're creating a picture by X-raying it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, thank you again for being my guest. Is there anything you want to announce as far as things you're doing? Or, I don't know, I should have given you a warning about this.
I have a Spanish test this week, guys, so if you'll just say a prayer for... No, I'm joking.
Will do. Alright, thank you for listening to the first episode of Cowboy Chemistry. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll come back for the second episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you.